You're listening to Charlottesville's Podcasting Network at cvillepodcast.com. Lectures, radio shows, and more are available on demand at cvillepodcast.com, now available through email. Sign up on our homepage. I'm Dan Gould. While the recession is clearly at the center of the Commonwealth's continuing fiscal shortfalls, the downturn has also revealed some serious underlying challenges with the state's revenue structure. Sarah Okos is the policy director at the Commonwealth Institute for Fiscal Analysis. She provided an overview of the issues the state faces in raising the resources necessary to meet public needs and introduced some key reform ideas for strengthening Virginia's path to economic recovery. Ms. Okos spoke at the October 12, 2011 meeting of the Senior Statesmen of Virginia. The meeting was held at the Charlottesville Senior Center. Following the presentation, questions were taken from the audience. The program was moderated by SSV Vice President Bob McGrath.
Sarah Okos received her bachelor's degree from Notre Dame in marketing and economics, and her master's degree in public policy from William & Mary's Thomas Jefferson Program in Public Policy, where she is policy director of the Commonwealth Institute, located in Richmond. The Institute's mission is to provide credible, independent, and accessible information and analyses of fiscal and economic issues facing Virginia, with particular attention to the impacts on low and moderate income people. This year, she received the Stettinius Award for Nonprofit Leadership from the Richmond Community Foundation. That doesn't mean that you don't get a salary, does it? In addition to this, all right. She is a member of this year's class in the Political Leaders Program here at the University of Virginia's Sorensen Institute for Political Leadership. Today, she will tell us about challenges facing tax policy in our Commonwealth, and in particular, creating a 21st century revenue system for a 21st century economy. Sarah, thanks for being here.
Well, good afternoon, everyone. I'm so grateful to be here with you all today, and I appreciate you coming out in this lovely weather to talk taxes, which I know is such an exciting topic, but I will do my best today to try to make it accessible and relevant and fun. I just want to throw out a little caveat here that certain aspects of my talk today are probably pretty technical, and I don't want to confuse anyone. There's a lot of jargon, so please stop me if we need further clarification on any issue or if I'm just not making sense to you. I'd like to address those sorts of issues as they arise. So I'd like to start by giving a very basic overview of our current tax structure here in Virginia. We are going to focus the discussion today on the state's general fund, which is about half of the overall budget, and those are the dollars that our legislators and our governor have the most discretion over their use and where they come from. So looking at the general fund here in this state, about 9 out of every $10 comes from just two revenue sources. Those are the sales and the income taxes, things that you're all very, very familiar with. In addition to that 9 out of $10, the rest comes from a number of other sources, such as the recordation tax, insurance premium taxes, public service gross receipt taxes, and a variety of other miscellaneous taxes. Now, I also want to note that I want to restrict the conversation today on state revenue sources. The state general fund, about half of that money then goes to localities in the form of direct aid. So localities are very dependent on state revenue sources. They have very limited taxing authority. So we're going to focus not on the taxes you're used to paying at the local level, property tax, a lot of business taxes, but on just state taxes. So looking at the Great Recession, which started in 2007, Virginia, like a number of other states, was just completely battered. Our revenues took unprecedented hits. In 2007, when we closed the fiscal year, we were about a percentage and a half below forecast on revenues, which was about $234 million. That seemed like a lot at the time, but over the next 3 years, we would close over $11 billion in revenue shortfalls. To put that in context, the general fund is usually around $15 to $17 billion a year, so 11 over a three-year period we're talking a lot of money. In 2009 and 2010, we had consecutive declines in revenue. And this is something that has never happened in the recorded history of the state. This means that in 2009, we closed with fewer resources than in 2008, and then in 2010, we closed with even fewer resources than 2009. In 2009 alone, we had a 9.6% decline in revenue. That's more than double the declines of the 2000 recession. So really the challenges that the Great Recession posed for our revenue system were just unprecedented. If we look at just fiscal year 11, which closed this past June, our total general fund revenues were below 2007 levels in nominal terms. I think that's pretty striking when you think about that. And then if we were to adjust for inflation, that comparison between pre-recession levels and post-recession levels looks even worse. So when we look at why we had these unprecedented declines in revenue, there are many drivers. A lot of them are macroeconomic in nature. But one that I want to focus on today is unemployment. And the reason I want to focus on unemployment is that not only did it cause these declines during the recession, but it's also going to continue to wreak havoc on our state revenue system until we can get more people back to work. So when we entered the recession, unemployment in Virginia was about 3%. Sounds good, right? It was fabulous. Over the course of the recession, we would climb to over 7% in 2009. And while this compared relatively well to other states, that was of cold comfort to Virginians who are out of work. This is where they live. This is where their families are. So the fact that our unemployment rate more than doubled really presented challenges here. And now that we're over 2 years beyond what was considered the official end of the recession. Economists declared the recession over in June of 2009, so we're now 2 years beyond that. Unemployment in the state is still hovering around 6%. So this is a problem. Why is this a problem? This is pretty basic. When people are out of work, they're not earning income. When they're not earning income, what aren't they doing? They're not paying income taxes. And on top of that, they're also not purchasing as many goods, which means that sales tax collections are going to take a hit too. So remember, I already told you that 9 out of every 10 general fund dollars comes from these two sources. So as long as unemployment is high in the state's general fund is going to feel the impact. Now, to put this in context, I want to look at the other side. We've talked about revenues for this period so far. But on the other side, we have to look at state needs. During the recession, as families dealt with joblessness, as they dealt with decreased hours and decreased wages, they became more and more dependent on some of the public services that our state provides. Programs like food stamps, temporary assistance for needy families, Medicaid. So we had this mismatch of decreased revenues and increased needs during the recession that really put a lot of stress on our revenue structure. So how did we deal with that $11 billion in missing revenues over the course of the recession? It was put together through a mix of strategies, but mainly program cuts. Roughly 40% of that $11 billion was reconciled through program cuts, which is a lot of money. Another 30% came from the federal government in the form of relief funds from the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act. Why these ERA funds, or Recovery Act funds, were so important is that they allowed us to protect things like K-12 education, and they also allowed us to cope with rising Medicaid enrollment. So I can't emphasize enough how the Recovery Act was truly a lifesaver in terms of balancing our budget during the recession. Another 7% of the shortfall was closed from withdrawing funds from our state's Revenue Stabilization Fund, which we affectionately refer to as the Rainy Day Fund, appropriate for a day like today. The Rainy Day Fund is a fund in which when revenues are coming in above projections, we stash away cash, and then when they fall below, we're able to withdraw them. There's a lot of constitutional rules around how much has to go in and how much can come out, but we were entirely right in using these resources during the recession. So before the recession, it was about $1.2 billion. We're down to a few hundred million. It's mainly depleted. You can only withdraw half of the total fund balance in any given year. So there's a lot of constitutional requirements around how much can be accessed to keep some small balance in the fund. And we also changed the rules to our rainy day fund during the course of the recession so that we could raise the maximum balance. There was a limit that could only be 10% of what's called certified tax revenues, so a mix of general fund sources. We raised that to 15%. So now we'll be able to build a bigger balance. So other ways that we closed the shortfall were through some tax policy changes, but that was only 6%. Very, very minor changes to tax policy during the recession. And finally, 22% of that gap was closed through deferring payments to our retirement system, which will have some repercussions going forward. So I'd like to tell you that this is all behind us and that there's blue skies ahead, but unfortunately, and our governor would agree with me right now, we're not out of the woods yet. So before we dig into some of the specific challenges going forward, I'd like to spend a few minutes on the surplus. I'm sure you all heard lots of news coverage this summer about the fact that Virginia closed fiscal year 2011 with money in the bank. So this is good news, of course. Revenues are coming in, that's great. But there's some underlying issues at play here that make this both a little more complicated and a little simpler than it might seem on the surface. So back in August, Governor McDonnell announced that we had a $545 million surplus. And basically what this means is that the projections that our state assumed in the budget this year for revenue were lower than actual collections. Think about that for just a second. So every year when we build the budget, we make some assumptions about what kind of money we expect to come in over the course of the year. The governor does this with his team of economic advisors, with his revenue forecasting team, and they present usually about three different scenarios: a standard forecast, a standard minus, and then a more optimistic forecast. Now, having just been through these treacherous times during the recession, Governor McDonnell and his team decided to take the more pessimistic view about what revenues would look like coming out of the recession. So we built the budget on these relatively pessimistic assumptions. Revenues began to tick up. What happened? We ended up with about $300 million more in general fund revenues than we expected. That's only half of the story. The other part of the surplus comes from the fact that we appropriated more funds to agencies than they ended up spending. That was another about $120 million. So in total, we ended the year with $545 million surplus, which is great, but again, there's some underlying issues. I'd like to get into those. So first, as I've already said, our budget relied very heavily on Federal Recovery Act funds. Those are gone. That was $3.1 billion brought into the Commonwealth during the downturn. This lifeline is over. Secondly, the 6% of tax policy changes that I explained earlier, those were mainly some creative accounting gimmicks. One in particular is called the Accelerated Sales Tax Program. And let me tell you what this means. So what this program does is require businesses to remit their sales taxes early and on estimates of what they think their sales will be. What it did effectively, the year that we passed it, was bring a month of revenue from the next fiscal year into the current fiscal year. So it's a shift of resources. It's a gimmick. It helped us in 1 year. So the governor will say that this doesn't help us anymore, and that is true. It only had an effect the first year. But at some point in time, we're going to have to face the music and unwind this trick, and it's going to result in less than 12 months of revenue in 1 year. So until we do that, we have a liability on the books. So on top of that, I can't emphasize enough the fact that we deferred payments to the Virginia retirement system. We do have a plan to pay that back, but it's going to cost us somewhere between about $75 and $80 million a year. So again, another liability to consider. And then there's the fact that we cut over $4 billion from the budget. We continue to have very large needs in terms of transportation. So it's not, our surplus is not evidence that there aren't needs in the state and that we're flush with cash. It is a very technical result of our revenue assumptions and spending assumptions, but it does not hit at some underlying issues in the state. So, on the flip side, I don't want to depress you all. A surplus is a good thing. Revenues are coming back. That's wonderful. But they're just not coming in at the level that we need for long-term growth in the state. A colleague of mine the other day described it in this way, and I think it's pretty compelling. If we all were to be state revenues, and during the recession, we fell off a 10-story building, then it's as if we've climbed our way back to about the fourth floor. That's great. We're making progress. We're getting where we need to be, but we're not where we need to be. So returning revenues are great. It's reason to celebrate, but we still have a very long way to go. Now, this December, Governor McDonnell will release his first full budget for fiscal years 13 and 14. This past July, a team of analysts in my office decided that we would try to tinker with some numbers and figure out whether resources were going to be in line with needs for the coming biennium. Basically, will there be another shortfall, or is the fact that we had this surplus evidence that we're going to be able to make the numbers line up going forward? So, without going into the methodology here, we took the spending levels passed in last year's budget, and we adjusted them for any expected changes that the state's own budget department assumes will happen going forward. And then we lined those up with the revenue assumptions that the governor assumed in the past budget going forward. We did some fancy math, and at the end of the day, we estimated about an $800 million shortfall for the next 2 years. This was July. Now, I'm not sure if you all heard this last week, but the governor issued a memo to state agencies requesting 2, 4, and 6% cut proposals as he puts together his budget. So if we look at that upper bound of 6% cut and we apply that to the state's budget, we're talking somewhere in the $900 billion range, pretty much exactly where we estimated in our own independent analysis. So I want to just put those two thoughts out there because I think that it's evidence that we still have these extreme challenges in front of us, and that this thought that because Virginia is performing relatively well compared to other states, we still have a lot to work on here. So why is this going to be difficult to deal with this $800, $900 billion surplus? I mean, excuse me, I wish it was a surplus shortfall going forward. Well, again, those Federal Recovery Act dollars are gone. That was really helpful. That allowed us to prevent cuts to education and healthcare at the time that we really needed those programs. Again, we have the $75 million a year to pay back to the Virginia retirement system. And the Rainy Day Fund, getting back to Bob's question earlier, we're going to be on the hook for putting money back into the fund. And that's because when revenues start coming in above projections, there's a constitutional requirement that we start putting a piece of that away to prepare for the next recession. So here we are, we survived the devastation of the recession, but it's time to turn on a dime and prepare for the next one. So basically the point here is that a lot of the tools we use to close the shortfall during the recession, they're not available to us anymore. Or also some of the strategies that we've used are placing demands on our returning revenue. So we just don't have all of the options that we had before. Now, one other way I can put this in context is to describe to you what is called a current services budget. And what a current services budget does is take a base year spending level and then inflate it for inflation and also for rising enrollment in certain programs and population growth. So if we were to look back at that pre-recession level of spending, so we're going to go back to the 2007 budget and then make these changes, these adjustments, to show if we had maintained those levels of public investment throughout the recession, where would we be today? Any guesses what that shortfall might look like? It's $8 billion. So we have $800 million looking forward for the next 2 years, but in real terms, these inflation adjustments and these changes for population growth, we're now $8 billion below where we were going into the recession. So I think that's pretty shocking, and it puts our challenges in context. So Looking ahead, we're done with the recession now, let's focus forward. There's three challenges in particular that I'd like to discuss with you. Two of them deal with our largest sources of general fund revenue, the income and the sales tax, and the third is going to cut across both of those systems. So our largest single source of revenue is the income tax. And over time, more and more income tax has been paid by individuals than by corporations. In the 70s, this mix was about 80-20, 80% individuals, 20% corporations. Recently, it looks more about 90-10. So there's been a shift of income tax liability to individuals versus corporations. So let's start with individual income tax because it's such a large source of revenue. Our current structure is progressive. And what I mean by that is that we have four brackets, four rates. As you go up in the brackets, you go up in the rates. But in practice, this works out to be pretty flat. And what I mean by that is that our highest rate of 5.75% kicks in at income just over $17,000. This means that effectively over 60% of Virginians are being taxed at the highest marginal rate. So the reason our system is so flat is that we've had a shifting income distribution and an unresponsive tax code. We haven't made any changes to our rates since 1987. In order to really align revenue growth in this state with growth in the economy, we need to be much more attuned to where income growth is occurring. And to the extent that income growth is occurring amongst higher earners, then our current system is going to leave us falling short. Briefly, the corporate income tax. Unlike the individual income tax, the corporate tax is a flat 6%, but it's a very volatile source of revenue, and that's because it applies only to corporate profits. A lot of businesses operate with pretty small margins, so one year they may have a high tax liability, the next maybe none at all. The Department of Taxation estimates that about 60% of corporations in Virginia in any given year will have zero tax liability. So when we think about the fact that more and more income taxes are being paid by individuals versus corporations, and that 60% of corporations are not paying anything in income taxes in the state, there's some questions there about whether, you know, there might be a better way forward. But shifting to the sales tax, we've made changes to the sales tax more recently than we have to the income tax, but it's just as out of touch with the reality of today's economy as the income tax. As a reminder, we have a 5% tax, 4% goes to the state, 1% is local. There are two major shifts in consumption patterns that are driving declining sales tax revenues. And the first has to do with a shift of the purchase of goods to the purchase of services. One of the most profound shifts in the economy at large in the United States has been the growth of the service industry. And if we look at the data, in 2007, households spent about half of their purchases on services. Just 30 years before that, it was less than a third. So more and more people are spending more and more money on services, not goods. And to the extent that our sales tax does not cover services, that's fewer and fewer sales tax dollars coming into the state. Now, because of this problem, a number of states have expanded their sales taxes to include more services. The Federation of Tax Administrators does a survey periodically of states, and there are 168 different services that they usually ask states to report on whether they include them in the sales tax base. Virginia is at the very bottom of the barrel. Only five states tax fewer services than we do. So another issue having to do with the sales tax has to do with the fact that people are buying more and more online, and a lot of online purchases are not being taxed. This is a problem with Congress. They have effectively prevented out-of-state, this is going to get technical, so bear with me, out-of-state vendors from, they have prevented states from requiring out-of-state vendors to collect sales taxes on purchases made in a state where they don't have a physical presence. So who are we talking about? It's companies like Amazon, who have no physical presence in most states, and yet a large number of purchases are made in that state, and all of those purchases are going untaxed. But that sales tax is legally due. The problem is that you and I, as the consumers, the responsibility lies on us to remit it to the state. This is difficult to enforce. Compliance costs are extremely high. So what happens? States just don't get the money. Now, a third issue, which doesn't have anything to do with a particular revenue source, but cuts across them, is what I'd like to call tax code spending. And there's been a lot of attention on this at the federal level, tax expenditures, which basically are all the special rates, the credits, the deductions, the deferrals, they're all littered through our tax code as special preferences. So when we think about the budget in the state, the only side that really gets attention is the appropriation side. How much are we investing in education? How much in transportation? But over $2.5 billion per year is not coming into the state's revenue coffers because of these tax breaks. And they don't go through the same appropriations process as appropriated spending. It's not like when our legislators gather to form the budget, they think, well, how much can we afford this year for special tax treatment of wineries, for instance? That is in the book. That credit is on the tax code, and so it operates essentially on autopilot. So what's happening here is because we don't manage these well, we don't know whether all these special tax preferences are achieving their intended purpose. We don't know who's benefiting from them. We don't know how much they're costing us. And so we could be losing a lot of money through these various tax loopholes. We just don't know. A good example of this is the Land Preservation Tax Credit. So this was a program that began in 1999, and it was designed to allow property owners that place their land in a preservation structure to get a credit against their income taxes. Sounds like a good deal. In 2002, without any research on how it was already performing, we expanded this to allow the sale of a credit if the credit exceeded a taxpayer's liability. So if your credit was larger than what you owe the state in taxes, you could sell it to someone else who could use it against their income taxes. What happened with this change is that the cost of the program skyrocketed. We went from a $2.2 million program in 2002 to a $200 million program in 2008. Are the results that different? Do we know what's happening? We don't. We have no idea whether this was actually a good direction to take the credit. So because we do such a poor job at monitoring them, there's a lot of room here for potential savings. I don't want to imply that some of these aren't achieving their intended purpose, that they're not incentivizing behavior, that they're not good for the state. The problem is that we just don't know. So since 1985, just to give you a little perspective, we have created or changed more than 60 of these tax expenditures. And the reason we know this is the Department of Taxation will periodically, usually upon the request of a legislator, issue some statement, some estimate of the cost of these recently enacted or changed programs. And that's where we get the estimate of $2.5 billion in foregone revenue. Just last session alone, our General Assembly passed or changed 20 of these things. And to give you a flavor for what they apply to, which is a very broad range of activities, we passed a credit for wine production, important to this area of the state, for spaceport activities, for teleworking, for long-term care insurance, and clean fuel vehicle job creation. So as you can see, we're using these to solve what are very diverse policy issues in the state. And what's key to making sure that these are good investments is that ongoing performance management that we are not doing currently. Because is this money well spent? That's a very fair question. And the answer is policymakers and the public just don't have the resources to truly evaluate that. So now I'd like to talk about some potential solutions to all these problems I've laid out, and also some lessons from other states. So luckily, Virginia is not the first state to deal with these problems. Many have grappled with these challenges in much larger ways than we are currently, much earlier, and so we have their experiences and efforts to look to. Before I get into specifics, there are a few concepts I want to lay on the table. The first, and these have to do with what a good revenue system would look like in this state. The first is adequacy. The very purpose of a revenue system is to create the resources that fund our public priorities and public investment in things like education, in a transportation system that is well-maintained and thorough, in strong public safety, and all those things that make Virginia a good place to live and learn and work and do business. So to the extent that our revenue structure is not producing the resources we need to attain all of those things, then it is inadequate. The second concept is stability. So not only do we want the revenue structure to produce the resources we need, but they need to be reliable. And that's just a simple kind of business concept. When we have very volatile revenues, it's very hard to plan. How do we make investments when we don't know that we can rely on a certain level of resources going forward? And finally, the stickiest concept is equity. So it's nearly impossible for people to determine or to agree upon what's fair. Everyone's going to have a different concept of what's fair. But there's two particular concepts in tax policy that we refer to as vertical and horizontal equity. And so I think these are a little bit useful in this discussion today. Vertical equity is going to relate to how taxpayers at different levels in the income distribution are treated. And so we get the terms here, regressive, proportional, progressive. So as I mentioned earlier, our state income tax is progressive, but essentially it works out to be fairly flat. Now, horizontal equity refers to how taxpayers across similar income, age, and household structures are treated. So to the extent that we would treat like people alike, then we have attained horizontal equity. So just keep those concepts in mind as we discuss some solutions. So first, with the individual income tax. As I mentioned earlier, we haven't changed this in over two decades. This is a problem because it creates what is referred to as bracket creep. And basically, what this means is that as people's income rises and we don't adjust the brackets, then more and more people and more income is pushed into a higher rate. So if we think back to 1987 and how many households probably had income over $17,000, that likely is a different share of our state's households and then than it is now. And so what we are doing by not adjusting these brackets is pushing more and more taxes on families and households that are less favorably situated to really handle this. And so we really need to work on aligning the system with the growth in our economy. As I mentioned, or I alluded to earlier, income growth in the state has been highly concentrated among high earners. The Institute just published a study yesterday that showed that just in the first year of the economic recovery, so 2009 to 2010, the top 10% of wage earners in the state saw about a 5% growth in their real wages. This is more than the bottom 10% of the state saw over a 30-year period. Just think about that for a second. It's pretty striking. So over 30 years, our lowest earners have seen smaller gains than our highest earners in the single year after the recession. That's pretty striking. So to the extent that we are not trying to piggyback our tax system off of where growth in income and ultimately growth in the economy is occurring, then we will likely to find ourselves falling short in terms of getting our revenues to align with our needs. So if we look at the sales tax, we have those two problems again, the shift to services and the shift to the internet. So let's talk about services first. I mentioned that there were 168 different services that the Federation of Tax Administrators survey states on. Any guesses on how many we tax in Virginia of 168? 18. Any idea what those are? I'm not sure you guys would be familiar with these. It's things like tuxedo rental, legal services, lawn services, computer services, a broad, broad range. And it can be things as simple as a health club membership to a haircut. That 168 is very broad. It's mainly household services. There's a few business services included in there too. But of that 168, Virginia only taxes 18. And as I said, this is stuff like diaper service, gift wrapping, tuxedo rental. I mean, these can't be bringing in that much money for the state. When we think about where the services that are growing and where the money is, they're going to be the hardest fight politically. Other states have tried Maryland has tried the lawn care services, computer programming services. I mean, there's big money there, but politically they're very difficult. These have very well-organized lobbies. Sure.
You mentioned the taxing of membership, say, in health clubs.
Sure.
As a tax of a service. So does that mean you would tax the dues of any membership organization?
Doesn't have to be that way. The state will have a lot of flexibility in determining what would be included and what wouldn't. Doesn't have to be that way.
Okay, but you see, from a philosophical point of view, that's...
And I don't want to advocate for taxing all 168, and that's not even an exhaustive list. There's clearly more than that 168. The point is just that as we shift in our consumption away from goods and to services, we're going to collect less and less revenue, and that's 20% of our general fund. We depend on the sales tax, so we've got to think about the base going forward. Was there another question? Okay. So aside from the revenue impact of including more services in the base, there's a few reasons that I want to touch on why this makes sense. So we just got into the fact that there's only so much room we can really adjust the tax rate on services. People will start to respond to a rate change on our current base. So we really have to look at the base and broadening that in order to diminish this effect of the shift in consumption patterns. But related to that point, bringing services into the sales tax base may also decrease the volatility of this vital source of revenue. So some limited research at the national level shows that when the economy tanks, services don't tank as much as goods tank in terms of purchasing. And when the economy booms, we don't see a rapid increase in the purchase of services in the same way that we do with durable goods. So remember that the sales tax currently is going to be really dominated by the purchase of big ticket items, cars, furniture, you know, big stuff. And so that is much more likely to those purchases are more likely to respond to economic conditions than services. So to the extent that we can include more services in the base, then we might see some sort of effect on volatility. But another issue here gets sort of at the equity concept of a tax system. And what I mean here is that under our current system, if I go to Lowe's and I buy a lawnmower, I'm going to pay sales tax on that lawnmower. Now, if I acquire the services of, you know, a lawn maintenance service, then I'm not going to pay taxes on that transaction. So the sales tax in our state is our most regressive tax. And what I mean by that is that lower income households pay a larger share of their total income in sales taxes than higher income households. And so to the extent that we treat goods and services differently, we're not doing anything to really mitigate the regressivity of this tax. But moving on to internet sales, there's a lot of options here for trying to chip away at all the untaxed sales on the internet. We really don't have too much authority to change the behavior of a company like Amazon because Congress is the one that really controls this. Until they change the law so that states can require these out-of-state vendors to collect taxes on in-state sales, there isn't too much we can do there. But states have gotten really creative about this, and they've worked around these sort of boundaries. New York is the most famous option here, and theirs is actually referred to as the Amazon law. And how they attempt to chip away at untaxed sales is by going after affiliate programs. And what this means is that I may be a nonprofit, I may be a small business, and on my website, I have a link to Amazon. So basically, I say, come buy this book, come buy this video. And when they click on my link, it goes to Amazon. When they purchase at Amazon, Amazon kicks back a commission to me. Because I live in Virginia, and I have a physical presence in Virginia, then technically, that tax is due, and I have to collect it. But because the purchase is made through Amazon, it's going untaxed. So it's this very complicated situation in which New York and many other states have followed suit, is trying to go after the affiliates and saying, okay, if you're making over this much money, and they set some threshold, which is reasonable, then you are required to collect and remit this sales tax. Now, Amazon, of course, does not like this at all, and they have threatened to end all their affiliate relationships in states where they've passed these types of laws. In some states, I believe that they have ended these affiliate programs. In others, I think it's an empty threat. I don't have the exact numbers on that. But what's interesting here politically is that this sort of issue really pits business against business. You have small bricks and mortar stores that are losing out because they're collecting sales tax like they're supposed to. And then you have these other small businesses, these affiliates, that are basically taking advantage of a loophole that's there. You know, that to the extent that they can make money by linking to Amazon via these commissions, then it makes sense for them to continue to do this. And so we have this unique situation in which small businesses are pitted against small businesses. So this Amazon law, similar to the New York law, has been tried in Virginia. It didn't pass, but I think it was two sessions ago, so I want to say the 2010 session, that Republican Senator Emmett Hanger fought for this pretty hard. The Department of Taxation estimated that this could bring in about $17 million. Now, I failed to mention earlier that by including more services in the sales tax base, that national studies suggest we could gain as much as $900 million. So clearly there's more bang for your buck with services than the internet. But probably the arguments for going after untaxed internet sales are stronger because it's really this unfair advantage that pits business against business. And the sales taxes are already due. You and I are supposed to be paying them on our own under the current system.
There's another aspect to this. You mentioned early on that one of the problems in collecting income tax was jobs. Mm-hmm. Well, for instance, if I were to start a mail order business, I would not want to have to deal with sending taxes to 50 different states. So people are going to be inhibited from starting small businesses like mail order businesses if they have to deal with this complication.
Under that situation, you would not have that problem. Because if you had a mail order business here and you only had a physical presence in Virginia, you would not have any reason to collect sales taxes in other states where you're not physically present.
Then they have the same problem that Virginia has now. Because they're not getting the sales taxes due them.
So the Amazon law, let me clarify this, the Amazon law is not going to get at all Amazon purchases. It would only get at those in which they are made through this broker, this affiliate that has a physical presence in the state.
But I'm not talking about Amazon. I'm talking about me starting a small business. So anyway, I don't want to belabor the point, but there is this other aspect.
Sure, sure. I just want to reiterate one more time there that you still have to have a physical presence in the state to be liable for the collection of sales taxes. So that's not even the only way that we can go about addressing this. Colorado has taken a vastly different approach, and it's one of transparency and reporting. So what they've tried to implement in Colorado, and it's still very early on, we don't know what the revenue impact is, we don't know what's going to happen, and there's been a lot of pushback, not just from these major e-retailers, but from citizens as well. It's a three-point prong. I have three-prong plan. So first of all, if you are an out-of-state retailer selling in the state and you sell more than a certain level of goods, and I think it's $100,000, then you have to do these three things. The first is you have to notify the purchaser that sales tax is legally due on this purchase. At the end of the year, you have to notify that consumer of how much they've purchased through you, how much that they owe to the state. And then finally, they have to report this to the state's Department of Revenue. So basically now, the excuse that I didn't realize I hadn't paid sales tax, I didn't know that it was due, they're trying to get at the issue from that angle. So this is a very different approach, but it's something that might be worth considering. So sounds like we have some pushback to some of these reforms. So let me just try to hit upon the arguments in favor of this sort of action. Again, it's not imposing a new tax. The tax is legally due already. In addition, this reduces that competitive disadvantage across businesses. It's going to treat your bricks and mortar sellers just like these affiliate programs. And then finally, this sort of law is going to work a little bit to reduce the disproportionate impact of sales taxes on lower-income households. When we look at the data around consumption patterns, lower-income households aren't making the same level of purchases over the internet as higher-level households. So this works to chip away at a little bit of that regressivity. So moving on to the corporate income tax, a very heated topic nationally and here in Virginia. So again, we have the 60% of corporations that have no tax liability. We have a shift of taxes from corporations to individuals. So what do we do about it? I have three suggestions for this. The first is an idea called mandatory combined reporting. And this is going to get pretty complicated. But basically, as business has gone global and more companies are operating in multiple states and in multiple countries, they have a lot of opportunities to shift their income amongst subsidiaries in a way that minimizes their tax liability. Not that they're doing anything wrong, they're being very smart and clever and working within the rules that are out there. But there's things that we can do to minimize those opportunities to shift income in such a way that they can reduce their liability. So mandatory combined reporting requires that a corporation combine on its state return the actions of all its subsidiaries. You treat everything as one consolidated corporation. By doing so, this really minimizes those opportunities to shift income in such a way that they owe less to the state in income taxes. Right now, Virginia has combined reporting as an option for corporations, but and some corporations do file this way. And one of the reasons they file this way is that it's similar to the way they file federally. So for simplicity's sake, some are going to have an incentive to do it the same way at the state level. Or for their particular book of business, that may be the way that makes the most sense for them in terms of their bottom line. So in order to see revenue gains here, we really need to make this reporting mandatory and not just an option. And again, because I said that corporations are used to doing this at the federal level, it's nothing new. When we look at the states that have corporate income taxes, which is about 44 or so states, 24 have passed this reform. So we're seeing a turning tide on this issue and a strong move towards combined reporting. In addition to that, there's another concept that's pretty technical called nowhere income. And what this means is that if I am a Virginia business and I make a sale to someone in a state where we have no physical presence, and in that state, without physical presence, they also don't have any kind of corporate taxation, then that income is going to go untaxed. And so we had a rule on the books to address this nowhere income until 1981, and this is called a throwback rule. So this would mean that if I had sales in a state where I don't have nexus, nexus just means this, you know, sufficient business contact. I don't have a presence. I don't employ people. I'm not present there. If the income isn't taxable there, it would get thrown back to Virginia. And so we've had this policy on the books. A number of states, they tend to be those same states that also enacted combined reporting, they've instituted these throwback rules to minimize the lost revenue through nowhere income. And then finally, another example for the corporate income tax has to do with how we peg our code to the federal code. So usually every year, Virginia will pass a bill that says, you know, the starting point for taxable income in the state is the same as the federal, but for these exceptions. And then we actively decide which federal policies we want to allow here and which don't make sense to us. There are a number of these policies that we have disallowed, and usually it's because of the revenue impact. It may be something that makes sense at the federal level, but the way that it plays out at the state, certain states are going to be big revenue losers. And so in those instances, we've already decoupled from some of these federal provisions. There's one in particular that I want to use as sort of an example here, and this is called the domestic production deduction. And this basically is a 9% income deduction for a broad range of production activities. Predominantly, you know, you think of different types of manufacturing. So it allows 9% against your corporate income tax. So the state level impact here is about $30 million a year. So because it applies to such a broad range of activities, there have been questions about whether this is really incentivizing manufacturing or production here, or whether it's basically basically wasteful spending on something that would have already happened anyways. So under Governor Kaine, Virginia flirted with just ending this altogether. That failed. Governor McDonnell has taken a slightly different approach. He's capped it at 6%. So while 9% is allowed on the federal return because of the state revenue impact, and this was an easy $10 million for him, he could keep it at 6 and save the $10 million. But we're still losing $20 million a year, and like those tax expenditures that I explained earlier, we don't know whether this is a good use of money in the state. So going forward, this is another area for the state to closely examine in terms of finding new revenue. Certain provisions at the federal level make sense. We should keep those. Others we may want to reconsider. So finally, I want to get back to those tax expenditures. Because Virginians really have the right to know whether this money is being used well via all these deductions and credits and deferrals and preferential rates that are sprinkled through the tax code, we have a responsibility to act as a better manager of these. And by putting out a regular report that includes a few basic concepts, we can make great progress here. So 41 states already report on their tax expenditures. Now, I want to caveat that with the fact that Virginia is considered one of those 41 states. We already have two reports on the books. One is a periodic review of exemptions to the retail sales and use tax. They'll pick a few exemptions every few years, do an estimate of the cost, and move on. Our other study is an annual report of exemptions and special preferences in the corporate income tax. Now, because a lot of businesses do not file as corporations in Virginia, this misses a large chunk of the preferences available to businesses in the state. So as you can see, by looking at various exemptions to the sales tax at one point in time, just a few isolated, and then also this corporate study that really misses all of the preferences available, we're falling short on these measures. Luckily, there are states that are doing a really good job of reporting. These are states like Minnesota, Connecticut, and Oregon. And really what makes their reports so successful is that they list the policy goal of each tool, what behavior the state is trying to incentivize, why this makes sense. They list who is benefiting from the preference and how much they're benefiting. So if we see that 90% of the benefit is accruing to three corporations in the state, it might be a red flag. And then also on top of that, we see the total cost. And so, as I mentioned with the land preservation tax credit, we have these initial assumptions about what these are going to cost. And they sound great. We think that we're going to get great bang for our buck on these various tax policies. But often that doesn't prove to be the case. And so by keeping our eye on the cost continuously, we can continue to make adjustments about whether this is the best use of state dollars. On the flip side, it also will allow us to highlight programs that are good performers. Some of these credits are doing their job, and they may be, you know, an excellent use of state dollars, but we don't know that. So better management of these and annual reporting so that basically the discussion of tax expenditures is brought into the regular budget debate on an annual basis is really key to making progress in terms of minimizing lost revenue here. So beyond just the reporting, though, there's one other process reform I want to introduce, and this is the idea of a sunset. So this is an approach that Oregon has taken, and a sunset basically is attached to any bill, in this case these tax expenditures, and says this will expire on this date. So if I pass a tax credit for some sort of behavior, let's say the purchase of computers, because we think as a state that this is helpful, then if it had a sunset that said 5 years, in 5 years that would go away but for action of the General Assembly on that tax expenditure. So by making these mandatory expirations, it forces our legislators to pay closer attention to what's going on here and to reevaluate periodically whether this makes sense to continue the program, whether they should be investing more money in the program, whether it should be expanded. So the sunset idea is definitely a good process reform. And finally, I think it's worth noting that there's evidence that this kind of reform resonates with our legislature. This past session, the Senate Finance Committee, which is the committee that hears all of these bills every year, they issued a policy statement on tax credits. And the policy statement was designed as a means of setting out how the committee would handle these bills going forward. And among the pieces of this policy proposal were the very sunsets I just introduced. Also, there were some key elements such as requiring fiscal impact analysis on a bill before it's heard in the committee. Often a bill will come up before the Department of Taxation or the Joint Legislative and Audit Review Commission will have a chance to really put a cost estimate on the bill. And so it's handled on what are the merits of the bill without any grounding in what the costs are. So this policy said that before they can be heard, there has to be fiscal impact analysis. The policy statement also said that all these bills will be taken up at the same point in the session. Right now, when they're dealing with hundreds of bills, and they get one here, and they get one there, and it sounds like a good idea, it's very easy to lose track of how many you've passed in a given session. So that's another element at play. A final one is a cap on the share of a taxpayer's tax liability that a credit can reduce. And they've capped that at 50%, which would mean that any refundable credit is now impossible, and that credits can only reduce half of what you owe to the state in the form of income taxes. So I think why this is important is that it illustrates this waning appetite for the tax credit as kind of the solution to every policy problem that the state is grappling with. So on that note, I'm going to end my remarks. Thank you for your interest. I've put a lot out there, so I'm very, very curious to hear your reactions to these ideas. Sure.
There are possibly two revenue sources I didn't hear you mention, gas tax and tolls on sure. interstates or other roads.
Sure.
And I was wondering maybe what impact those are having or could have potentially.
Sure. So I didn't discuss the number of the excise taxes because most of those operate outside of the general fund. Those are going to be earmarked for various purposes. So those will go in our non-general fund, which is the other 50 to 60% of the budget. Of course, those have been considered as means. I mean, the gas tax in particular for transportation and funding the Transportation Trust Fund. A number of bills are entered every session to make various changes to the gas tax. And so I just didn't address them today because we're focusing on the general fund. But that's definitely another area that we can look. I think some analysis around how much wiggle room we have with the gas tax and how much money that actually yields proves to be inadequate for our transportation needs. So there seems to be some consensus that the gas tax, it may be a part of the solution, but it can't fully fund transportation.
That may be true. As I understand, the gas tax had been increased from the 16 plus cents since 1960s.
I think it's the 80s, but yes.
80s, mm-hmm. yeah. Mm-hmm. And yet, many states index their tax to the price of gas.
Yes.
Everything that you've said so far discourages me about how our legislatures are reacting to the situation that you described since 2007, mm-hmm. and that little seems to have been done to correct it from generating more revenues.
Yeah, one thing that's brought up on the gas tax frequently, and a number of states, you know, have a different system than we do where it is indexed to inflation or it's linked to the gas price. We often hear this pushback that it will drive up costs in Virginia so much. And yet, when we look at the gas tax in North Carolina, we look at border gas stations, they have a much higher gas tax than we do, and yet their price that the consumer pays at the pump isn't really that different. It's quite marginal.
Just an observation on the gasoline tax is increasingly an obsolete tax. What has happened, of course, with the great increase in fuel costs, that's been an incentive for people to purchase, well, for manufacturers to make much more fuel-efficient cars and for people to begin to favor them. On top of that, after a very long period, when the federal standards for fuel efficiency didn't have much meaning, they're really beginning to bite. And also they're going to apply to trucks. And so these are factors for the future that are going to really slow the growth, no matter what the rate going to really slow the growth of fuel tax revenue. Now, my good friend, Professor George Hoffer, BCU, is in favor of a vehicle miles travel tax, which has a lot of intellectual appeal to economists like myself, but it faces a formidable barrier in regard to concerns about privacy.
Yes.
Oregon did an experiment on it and used GPS technology, and certainly it would be possible to impose a vehicle miles travel tax, which could even cover what roads you're traveling on, the time of day you're traveling. It could be a congestion tax. It's got all sorts of interesting mm-hmm. features. But it may be something for the future, something to think about.
Yes, definitely.
Because you've got to take into account that with the population of Prius cars and such growing all the time, much greater fuel efficiency.
Exactly.
It's not a growth source of revenue.
Yep.
I had a follow-up on the tolls. You didn't address the toll charges. What's the thinking there as far as imposing tolls on the interstates or other
sure.
roads, and how's that affect the revenue? I know it's not the general fund, but it's...
I can't really speak to the adequacy. I'm not sure how much that yields or whether that's our best option, but I know I can speak to the political viability of it, and there seems to be more appetite for anything that's considered a user fee. And so to the extent that we can toll certain areas and strategically toll certain areas of the state, I think we're going to see more and more of that as an option here in Virginia.
It's my understanding that the problem of the so-called remote seller,
mm-hmm.
the Amazon, the eBay, the QVC,
mm-hmm.
may be going away, but that more and more of them are changing to business models that entail brick-and-mortar locations.
Mm-hmm. There is some evidence of that. Particularly, there were, and I don't want to name out any corporations I'm not sure of, but some corporations that their online business was a separate entity from their bricks-and-mortar stores. And we've seen a shift away from that, where it's become one entity so that they are collecting more sales tax online.
I seem to have the microphone now. Your remarks about this legislative policy statement makes
yes.
me think that there's more room for adaptation here on the corporate tax side. But that's not really where the problem is, in a sense, with this. We're sort of fifth, I guess, in the point at which the top tax bracket kicks in, and this is just so antediluvian. I mean, is there any hope for changing our tax brackets?
Well, I was hoping you might have an answer there. I mean, I can speak to the fact that there are a few legislators that work on this, and they introduce bills every year, and they routinely are not even picked up by the committee that hears them and the House of Delegates. So right now there's very little appetite for changes to the income tax. But I think going forward, as we continue to struggle with this system that's just not producing enough resources to fund needs that most people will agree on are the needs of our state. I mean, some people are going to think we need to be investing more in certain areas than others. But I think we may get to this point where we're not even able to fund our basic public priorities. That the income tax is really where the most opportunity lies. The smallest changes can yield the most dollars, and a modernization package could be structured which reduces the rates among certain brackets, and by creating new brackets and higher rates, it could result in a tax decrease for a large portion of Virginians. So I think that right now we're just not at the point where this is really politically viable, but we may get there.
This is with regards to the jobs issue.
Sure.
We used to have a textile factory here in Charlottesville, and there were a lot of clothing factories in southwestern Virginia.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, now all that money is going to China. So here's a proposal which almost no one will consider, but which could increase jobs and income tax revenue. and that is legislate school uniforms and require that they be made in Virginia.
I'll take that one back to Richmond.
I have a question. How does, so your talk is understandably about increasing revenues and equity and so forth, but how does the tax revenue in Virginia compared to GDP in Virginia compare to other states?
So some analysis that we do at the Commonwealth Institute is tracking various revenue sources as a share of personal income in the state. And these are going to look like very small shares because we're a pretty wealthy state. And often we refer to this as a high capacity state, low effort state, where our budget is, it's not small, but in terms of our overall wealth in the state, it's that ratio is smaller than in a number of other states. But when we look at these tax revenues as a share of personal income over time, we've seen slight reductions.
But how does it compare to other states?
I can't do that, and I don't know that comparison. I only know the overall budget is the size of the economy.
I'd like to interject that such a comparison is inappropriate.
Okay.
Because the states vary so much in the relative responsibilities of the state government and the local governments. So the relevant comparison is state and local.
I apologize. I'm sorry. These numbers are state and local. Total revenue.
Oh,
that's
okay.
Exactly right, and I intended to ask that.
Yes. No, I apologize. That was my mistake.
Okay. Did I miss? I thought you were asking just state taxes.
I did, but I should have said what
you said. Yeah, state and local. Okay. That just.
Yes. No, I apologize for not saying that. These are state and local in total because that mix varies dramatically from state to state. And here, because localities have such minimal taxing authority compared to other states, the state is really where the revenue action occurs.
This, for some bizarre reason, I find a fascinating topic. And I...
Thank you.
I look about once a month at a document that everybody here can access on the internet easily, which is if you Google who pays three, W-H-O-P-A-Y-S, three, it's the third iteration of this, by the Institution of Taxation and Economic Policy. It's a nonprofit, nonpartisan group in Washington, from which I gleaned the information that the lowest 10% of income earners in Virginia, now this is for 2007, paid 8.8% of their income in combined income, sales, property, excise taxes, so the whole ball of wax as far as tax is concerned, whereas the highest 1% paid 5.5% of their income across that whole range of taxes. What's really fascinating is to answer, or maybe tangentially some of these other questions about state, federal, locality, is that you can look up every state and see where the tax burden falls. And then there's a very clear and compelling sort of introduction that gives you the tools to compare them.
Yeah.
So who pays three?
Yeah, we work with the Institute on Taxation and Economic Policy a lot, particularly to do distributional analysis around a tax policy change. So say we were to increase the sales tax by half a cent, how would that break out by income level? You know, what would be the impact? How many dollars would the middle 20%, you know, what would that cost them in a year? So we work with them to do a lot of that modeling. And what's interesting with that report in particular is that you see which revenue sources are really the more regressive sources, and the states that their mix of revenues is more dependent on those than they're the more regressive states. And so Washington in particular, every time that they publish this report, Washington is always the most regressive state. And we don't think of politically as Washington being that way, but it's because they're so dependent on the property tax versus the income tax that you have this higher burden on lower income households.
We really don't know for the future, but it strikes me that if they come to some accommodation in Washington, this super commission and such, it may well have tax implications. And have you thought or speculated about how some federal tax changes could affect the states and specifically Virginia? And for example, I'm thinking of if the special treatment of mortgage interest were ended, or at least capped out, or if the special treatment of employer paid health insurance were removed or partially removed. In a way, if Virginia then, on its modified conformity, chose to adjust to that new base, that could mean additional revenue, or there are ways that this thing could go the other way. I just would be interested in your thoughts.
Yeah, I mean, we'd be very interested in doing that type of analysis as soon as there are more real proposals on the table. What we are looking at right now is just the impact of federal cuts on the economy in Virginia in terms of jobs. That's going to be a huge concern, not only jobs, but just lost GDP. This summer, when Governor McDonnell made the announcement of the surplus, he also introduced this idea of this fund, where it's kind of another rainy day fund, where we're going to save up some money to deal with what is this uncertainty around federal action. So I think the initial investment is he's suggested about $30 million, which doesn't seem like that much, considering our strong relationship with the federal government in terms of employment in the state. But that's something that we at the Institute are very interested in trying to estimate, is the impact of cuts. But the tax policy is interesting too, and as soon as there are proposals, we'll try to pursue that kind of analysis.
I want to back up what Jerry Donnelly said about Made in America. There is a program going on in perhaps other states that they have everything made in America. For instance, in construction, 90% of the nails come from China. But different construction companies went around and found out that there was a business that made nails in America. And so they insisted that everything that went into the housing and building situations were made in America. And therefore, the income tax, sales tax, the revenue from just made in America would increase. And this is something that has already been started. So I strongly back what Jerry said. A second point I want to bring up is we have in Albemarle County two people who are very knowledgeable in tax and revenue, and one of them is Senator Emmett Hanger, who represents a part of Albemarle County and is on the Senate Finance Committee. Mm-hmm. And he has an extensive knowledge in tax. He was an Augusta County tax administrator. Other one is Delegate Steve Landis, and he's on the House Appropriations Committee. So if anyone has a thought about how to raise revenue or cut spending, those two people are the ones that we should contact, because they represent our county and they are very well attuned to listening to people. So I recommend talking to Steve Landis as delegate or Emmett Hanger. And Emmett Hanger has tried to do a marvelous job in tax reform. And he's run up against a lot of opposition in his own party, but he's someone to talk to.
Yes, he's been a real rational voice on this issue at the General Assembly.
Your comments about making sunset laws and actually trying to understand what the benefit of tax expenditures are for the Commonwealth, it's so poignant, because if only we could have that at the federal level, right? In any event, I want to thank you. This has been an exceedingly informative and thought-provoking and even entertaining, if one can use that and talk about taxes. But anyway, thank you very much for visiting us, and let's give her another hand.
For the Charlottesville Podcasting Network, I'm Dan Gould.